In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
You walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to another news. I'm Jeff Brady. Within 2 weeks, the lives of billions of people were brought to a sudden stop, and it became clear that something beyond an international health protocol system was being implemented as governments worldwide issue emergency plans. We recently looked at the 5G millimeter wave wireless radiation correlation and the rapid spread of the coronavirus in cities such as Milan, Seattle, and Wuhan with Dr. Martin Paul. There were also subsequent alerts regarding 5G wireless systems covertly being installed in schools during the shutdowns. There are many opportunities for agendas, such as the now well-known Agenda 21 in 2030. However, in addition, there is the threat of martial law and the covering up of Wall Street derivative and credit swap profit schemes and the subsequent meltdown. And also the sudden stepping down of CEOs late last year and this year, including Bill Gates. There's an interesting story examining the transmissibility of the COVID-19 virus. It's reposted on ZeroHedge.com because it was removed from its original site. It's titled COVID-19, Evidence Over Hysteria by Aaron Ginn, G-I-N-N. Let's take a look at that. Total cases are the wrong metric. A critical question to ask yourself when you first look at a data set is, what is our metric for success? Let's start at the top. How is it possible that more than 20% of Americans believe they will catch COVID-19? Here's how. Vanity metrics, a single data point with no context. And the Johns Hopkins COVID-19 tracking map everyone has seen, they're now infamous, what started as a data transparency effort is now molded into an unintentional tool for hysteria and panic. An important question to ask yourself is, what do these bubbles actually mean? Each bubble represents the total number of COVID-19 cases per country. The situation looks serious, yet we know that this virus is more than 4 months old. So how many of these cases are active? Immediately, we see that just under half of those terrifying red bubbles aren't relevant or actionable. The total number of cases isn't illustrative of what we should do now. This is a single vanity data point with no context. It isn't information or knowledge. To know how to respond, we need more numbers to tell a story and to paint the full picture. As a metaphor, the daily revenue of a business doesn't tell you a whole lot of profitability, capital structure, or overhead. The same goes for the total number of cases. The data isn't actionable. We need to look at ratios and percentages to tell us what to do next: conversion rate, growth rate, and severity. Time-lapsing new cases gives us perspective. Breaking down each country by the date of the first infection helps us track the growth and impact of the virus. We can see how total cases are growing against a consistent time scale. And in the graph below, they show how the coronavirus case trajectories compare country to country. And it shows the United States is tracking with European nations at doubling every 3 days or so. As we measure and test more Americans, this number will continue to grow. Our time-lapse growth is lower than China, but not as good as South Korea, Japan, Singapore, or Taiwan. All are considered models of how to beat COVID-19. The United States is performing average, not great, compared to the other modern countries by this metric. Still, there's a massive blind spot with this type of graph. None of these charts are weighted on a per capita basis. It treats every country as a single entity, As we will see, this fails to tell us what's going on in several aspects. On a per capita basis, we shouldn't be panicking. Every country has a different population size, which changes the aggregate and cumulative case comparison. By controlling for population, you can properly weigh the number of cases in the context of the local population size. Viruses don't acknowledge our human borders. The U.S. population is 5.5 times greater than Italy, 6 times larger than South Korea, and 25% the size of China. Comparing the U.S. total number of cases in absolute terms is rather silly. Rank ordering based on the total number of cases shows that the U.S. on a per capita basis is significantly lower than the top 6 nations by case volume. On a 1 million citizen per capita basis, the U.S. moves to above mid-pack of all countries and rising, with similar case volume as Singapore, 385 cases, and Cyprus, 75 cases, and the United Kingdom, 3,983 cases. This is data as of March 20th, 2020. But total cases, even on a per capita basis, will always be a losing metric. The denominator, which is the total population, is more or less fixed. We aren't having babies at the pace of viral growth. Per capita won't explain how fast the virus is moving and if it is truly exponential. COVID-19 is spreading, but probably not accelerating. Growth rates are tricky to track over time. Smaller numbers are easy to move than larger numbers. As an example, GDP growth of 3% for the U.S. means billions of dollars, while 3% for Bermuda means millions. Generally, growth rates decline over time, but the nominal increase may still be significant. This holds true of daily confirmed case increases. Daily growth rates declined over time across all countries, regardless of particular policy solutions, such as shutting the borders or social distancing. This is a little abstract here. Weighing daily growth of confirmed cases by a relative daily growth factor cleans up the picture. More than one is increasing and below one is declining. For all of March, the world has hovered around 1.1. This translates to an average daily growth rate of 10% with ups and downs on a daily basis. This isn't great, but it is good news, as COVID-19 most likely isn't increasing in virality. And that's spelled V-I-R-A-L-I-T-Y. The growth rate of the growth rate is approximately 10%. However, the data is quite noisy. With inconsistent country-to-country reporting and what qualifies as a confirmed case, the more likely explanation is that we are increasing our measurement, but the virus hasn't increased in viral capability. Recommended containment and prevention strategies are still quite effective at stopping the spread. Cases around the world are increasing. It is a virus after all. But beware of believing metrics designed to intentionally scare, such as cases doubling. These are typically small numbers over small numbers and sliced on a per country basis. Around the world, COVID-19's growth rate is rather steady. Remember, viruses ignore our national boundaries. Viruses don't grow infinitely forever and ever. As with most things in nature, viruses follow a common pattern, a bell curve. Watch the bell curve as COVID-19 spreads and declines, which it will decline despite what the media tells you. Every country will follow a similar pattern. The following is a more detailed graph of South Korea's successful defeat of COVID-19 compared to China, with thousands of more cases and death. It is a bell curve. And then they show a more detailed graph of South Korea graphed against the total number of cases. And then there is a graph from Italy showing a bell curve in symptom onset and number of cases, which may point to the beginning of the end for Italy. Bell curves is the dominant trait of outbreaks. A virus doesn't grow linearly forever. It accelerates, plateaus, and then declines. Whether it's environmental or our own efforts, viruses accelerate and quickly decline. This fact of nature is represented in Farr's Law. That's F-A-R-R. It is important to note that in both scenarios, the total number of COVID-19 cases will be similar. Flattening the curve's focus is a shock to the healthcare system, which can increase fatalities due to capacity constraints. In the long term, it isn't infection prevention. Unfortunately, quote, flattening the curve, doesn't include other downsides and costs of execution. Both the CDC and the WHO are optimizing virality and healthcare utilization while ignoring the economic shock to our system. Both organizations assume you are going to get infected eventually, and it won't be that bad. The low probability of catching COVID-19. The World Health Organization released a study on how China responded to COVID-19. Currently, this study is one of the most exhaustive pieces published on how the virus spreads. The results of their research show that COVID-19 doesn't spread as easily as we first thought or the media had us believe. Remember, people abandoned their dogs out of fear of getting infected. According to their report, if you come in contact with someone who tests positive for COVID-19, you have a 1 to 5% chance of catching it as well. The variability is large because the infection is based on the type of contact and how long. The majority of viral infections come from prolonged exposures in confined spaces with other infected individuals. Person-to-person and surface contact is by far the most common cause. From the WHO report, quote, when a cluster of several infected people occurred in China, it was most often 78 to 85% caused by an infection within the family by droplets and other carriers of infection in close contact with an infected person. From the CDC's study on transmission in China and the Princess Cruise outbreak, quote, a growing body of evidence indicates that COVID-19 transmission is facilitated in confined settings. For example, a large cluster, 634 confirmed cases of COVID-19 secondary infections occurred aboard a cruise ship in Japan, representing about one-fifth of the persons aboard who were tested for the virus. This indicates the high transmissibility of COVID-19 in enclosed spaces. Dr. Paul Auerder, the clinical director for the Division of Infectious Disease at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, echoes this finding. If you have a COVID-19 patient in your household, your risk of developing the infection is about 10%. If you were casually exposed to the virus in the workplace, for example, you weren't locked up in the conference room for 6 hours with someone who was infected, like a hospital, your chance of infection is about 0.5%. According to Dr. Auerder, these transmission rates are very similar to the seasonal flu. Air-based transmission or untraceable community spread is very unlikely. According to the WHO's COVID-19 lead, Maria Van Kerkhove, true community-based spreading is very rare. The data from China shows that community-based spread was only a very handful of cases. Quote, this virus is not circulating in the community, even in the highest incidence areas across China, she says. She says, quote, transmission by fine aerosols in the air over long distances is not one of the main causes of spread. Most of the 2,055 infected hospital workers were either infected at home or in the early phase of the outbreak in Wuhan when hospital safeguards were not raised yet, she said. true community spread involves transmission where people get infected in public spaces and there's no way to trace back the source of infection. The WHO believes that is not what the Chinese data shows. If community spread was super common, it wouldn't be possible to reduce the new cases through social distancing. Quote, we have never seen before a respiratory pathogen that's capable of community transmission, but at the same time, which can also be contained with the right measures. If this was an influenza epidemic, we would have expected to see widespread community transmission across the world right now, and efforts to slow it down or contain it would not be feasible, said Tedros Adhanom, Director General of the WHO. An author of a working paper from the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at Princeton University said, quote, the current scientific consensus is that most transmission via respiratory secretions happens in the form of large respiratory droplets rather than small aerosols. Droplets, fortunately, are heavy enough that they don't travel very far and instead fall from the air after traveling only a few feet. The media was put into a frenzy when the above authors released their study on COVID-19's ability to survive in the air. The study did find the virus could survive in the air for a couple of hours. However, this study was designed as academic exercise rather than a real-world test. The study put COVID-19 into a spray bottle to mist it into the air. I don't know anyone who coughs in mist form, and it's unclear if the viral load was large enough to infect another individual. As one doctor who wants to remain anonymous told me, quote, Corona doesn't have wings. To summarize, China, Singapore, and South Korea's containment efforts worked because community-based and airborne transmission aren't common. The most common form of transmission is person-to-person or surface-based. COVID-19's ability to live for a long period of time is limited on most surface, and it's quite easy to kill with typical household cleaners, just like the normal flu. COVID-19 can be detected on copper after 4 hours and 24 hours on cardboard. COVID-19 survived best on plastic and stainless steel, remaining viable for up to 72 hours. COVID-19 is very vulnerable to UV light and heat, but presence doesn't mean infectious. The viral concentration falls significantly over time. The virus showed a half-life of about 0.8 hours on copper, 3.46 hours on cardboard, 5.6 hours on steel, and 6.8 hours on plastic. According to Dylan Morris, one of the authors, quote, we don't know how much virus is actually needed to infect a human being with high probability, nor how easily the virus is transferred from the cardboard to one's hand when touching a package. According to Dr. Auerder, quote, it's thought that this virus survives on a surface, such as your hands, hard surface, and fabric. Preliminary data indicates up to 72 hours on hard surface like steel and plastic, and up to 12 hours on fabric. COVID-19 will likely burn off in the summer. Due to COVID-19's sensitivity to UV light and heat, just like the normal influenza virus, it is very likely that it will burn off as humidity increases and temperatures rise. Released on March 10th, one study mapped COVID-19 virality capability by high temperature and high humidity. It found that both significantly reduced the ability of the virus to spread from person to person. From the study, quote, this result is consistent with the fact that the high temperature and high humidity significantly reduced the transmission of influenza. It indicated that the arrival of summer and rainy season in the northern hemisphere can effectively reduce the transmission of the COVID-19. The University of Maryland mapped severe COVID-19 outbreaks with local weather patterns around the world, from the U.S. to China. They found that the virus thrives in a certain temperature and humidity channel. Quote, the researchers found that all cities experiencing significant outbreaks of COVID-19 have a very similar winter climate with an average temperature of 41 to 52 degrees Fahrenheit, an average humidity level of 47 to 79%, with a narrow east-west distribution along the same 30 to 50 north latitude. Quote, based on what we have documented so far, it appears that the virus has a harder time spreading between people in warmer tropical climates. And there's a pretty interesting image below. The zone at risk for a significant community spread in the near term, including land areas with the green bands, and that's right across the central part of the U.S. and patchy areas along the western mountain ranges of the U.S. and Washington State, and it looks like parts of British Columbia. Children and teens aren't at risk. It's already established that the young aren't particularly vulnerable. In fact, there isn't a single death reported below the age of 10 in the world, and most children who test positive don't show symptoms. As well, infection rates are lower for individuals below the age of 19, which is similar to SARS and MERS, COVID-19's sister viruses. According to the WHO's COVID-19 mission in China, only 8.1% of cases were 20-somethings, 1.2% were teens, and 0.9% were 9 years old or younger. As of the study date, February 20th, 78% of the cases reported were ages 30 to 69. The WHO hypothesizes this for a biological reason and isn't related to lifestyle or exposure. Quote, even when looked at households, we did not find a single example of a child bringing the infection into the household and transmitting it to the parents. It was the other way around, and the children tend to have a mild disease, said Van Kerkhove. According to the Wall Street Journal article, children have a near zero chance of becoming ill. They are more likely to get normal flu than COVID-19. A World Health Organization report on China concluded that cases of COVID-19 in children were, quote, relatively rare and mild. Among cases in people under 19, only 2.5% developed severe disease, while 0.2% developed critical disease. Among nearly 6,300 COVID-19 cases reported by the Korea Centers for Disease Control and Prevention on March 8th, there were no reported deaths in anyone under 30. Only 0.7% of infections were in children under 9, and 4.6% of cases were in those ages 10 to 19 years old. Only 2% of the patients in a review of nearly 45,000 confirmed COVID-19 cases in China were children. And there were no reported deaths in children under 10, according to a study published in JAMA last month. In contrast, there have been 136 pediatric deaths from influenza in the U.S. this flu season. About 8% of cases were among people in their 20s. Those 10 to 19 years old accounted for 1% of cases, and those under 10 also accounted for only 1%. However, even if children and teens are not suffering severe symptoms themselves, they may shed large amounts of virus and may do so for many days, says James Campbell, a professor of pediatrics at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. Children had a virus in their secretions for 6 to 22 days, or an average of 12 days. Quote, shedding virus doesn't always mean you're able to transmit the virus, he notes. It's important to consider that prolonged shedding of high viral loads from children is still a risky combination within the home, since the majority of transmission occur within a home-like confined environment. A strong but unknown viral effect. While the true viral capacity is unknown at this moment, it is theorized that COVID-19 is more than the seasonal flu but less than other viruses. The average number of people to which a single infected person will transmit the virus, or RO, range from as low as 1.5 to a high of 3.0. Newer analysis suggests this viral rate is declining. According to Nobel laureate and biophysicist Michael Levitt, the infection rate is declining. Quote, every coronavirus patient in China infected on average 2.2 people a day, spelling exponential growth that can only lead to disaster. But then it started dropping, and the number of new daily infections is now close to zero. Quote, he compared it to interest rates again. Quote, even if the interest rate keeps dropping, you still make money. The sum you invested doesn't lessen, it just grows more slowly. When discussing disease, it frightens people a lot because they keep hearing about new cases every day. But the fact that the infection rate is slowing down means the end of the pandemic is near. What about asymptomatic spread? The majority of cases see symptoms within a few days, not 2 weeks, as originally believed. The majority of cases see symptoms within a few days, not 2 weeks, as originally believed. On true asymptomatic spread, the data is still unclear, but increasingly unlikely. Two studies point to a low infection rate from pre-symptomatic and asymptomatic individuals. One study said 10% of infections come from people who don't show symptoms yet. Another WHO study reported 1.2% of confirmed cases were truly asymptomatic. Several studies confirming asymptomatic spread have ended up disproven. It is important to note there is a difference between, quote, never showing symptoms and pre-symptomatic, and the media is promoting an unproven narrative. Almost all people end up in the latter camp within 5 days, almost never the former. It is very unlikely for individuals with COVID-19 to never show symptoms. WHO and CDC claim that asymptomatic spread isn't a concern and quite rare. Iceland is leading the world in testing its entire population of 300,000 for asymptomatic spread, not just those that show symptoms. They randomly tested 1,800 citizens who don't show symptoms and, as far as they knew, were not exposed to positive individuals. On the sample, only 19 tested positive for COVID-19, or 1.1% of the sample. Obviously, this type of viral spread is the most concerning. However, based on the level of media attention and the worldwide size of positive infections, it seems more probable we keep looking for a COVID-19 viral trait that doesn't exist. Another way of looking at virality and asymptomatic spread is the number of flight attendants, airport staff, or pilots that have tested positive for COVID-19. Out of the thousands of flights since November 2019, only a handful of airport and airline staff have tested positive, such as American Airlines pilot, some British Airways staff, and several TSA employees. Outside of medical and hospital staff, these individuals are in greatest contact with infected persons in confined spaces. Despite having no protective gear, and most likely these people were asymptomatic, airline and airport staff aren't likely to catch COVID-19 compared to the rest of the population. Those employed in the travel sector are infected at a lower rate than the general population or healthcare workers. Quote, We still believe, looking at the data, that the force of infection here, the major driver, is people who are symptomatic, unwell, and transmitting to others along the human-to-human route. This is from Dr. Mike Ryan of WHO Emergencies Program. If the symptoms are so close to other less fatal coronaviruses, what is the positivity rate of those tested? 93% of people who think they are positive aren't. 93% of people who think they are positive aren't. Looking at the success in South Korea and Singapore, the important tool in our war chest is measurement. If we are concerned about the general non-infected population, what is the probability those who show symptoms actually test positive? What is the chance that the cough from your neighbor is COVID-19? This, quote, conversion rate will show whether or not you have a cold, another coronavirus, or heading to isolation for 2 weeks. Worldwide data shows that 95% of people who are tested aren't positive. The positivity rates vary by country. And they give a list from going through the UK, Iceland, France, Austria, South Korea. In the United States, drive-through testing facilities are being deployed around the country. Governor Cuomo of New York released initial data from their drive-through testing. Out of the 600 tested in a single day, 7% were positive. Tested individuals actively show symptoms and present a doctor's note. This result is similar to the public tracking on U.S. nationwide positivity rate. And this is based on data from March 20th. As the U.S. continues to expand testing, the case fatality rate will decline over the next few weeks. There's little doubt that serious and fatal cases of COVID-19 are being properly recorded. What is unclear is the total size of mild cases. WHO originally estimated a case fatality rate of 4% at the beginning of the outbreak, but revised estimates downward 2.3% to 3% for all age groups. CDC estimates 0.5% to 3%, however, stresses that closer to 1% is more probable. Dr. Paul Auerter estimated 0.5% to 2%, leaning towards the lower end. A paper released on March 19th analyzed a wider data set from China and lowered the fatality rate to 1.4%. This won't be clear for the U.S. until we see the broader population that is positive but with mild cases. With little doubt, the fatality rate and severity rate will decline as more people are tested and more mild cases are counted. Higher fatality rates in China, Iran, and Italy are more likely associated with a sudden shock to the healthcare system, unable to address demands, and doesn't accurately reflect viral fatality rates. As COVID-19 spread throughout China, the fatality rate drastically fell outside of Hubei. This was attributed to the outbreak slowing spreading to several provinces with low infection rates. Jean-Pierre Ioannidis is a professor of medicine of epidemiology and population health at Stanford University. He writes, "The one situation where an entire closed population was tested was the Diamond Princess cruise ship and its quarantine passengers. The case fatality rate there was 1.0%, but this was largely an elderly population in which the death rate from COVID-19 is much higher. Projecting the Diamond Princess mortality rate onto the age structure of the U.S. population, the death rate among people infected with COVID-19 would be 0.125%. But since this estimate is based on extremely thin data, there were just 7 deaths among the 700 infected passengers and crew, the real death rate could stretch from 5 times lower, 0.025%, to 5 times higher, 0.625%. It is also possible that some of the passengers who were infected might die later, and that tourists may have a different frequency of chronic disease, a risk factor for worse outcomes with SARS-CoV-2 infection than the general population, adding these extra sources of uncertainty. Reasonable estimates for the case fatality ratio in the general U.S. population vary from 0.05% to 1%. Looking at the U.S. fatality, the fatality rate is drastically declining as the number of cases increase, halving every 4 or 5 days. The fatality rate will eventually level off and plateau as the U.S. case mix becomes apparent. What a great article. And then it ends, "So what should we do?" Local governments and politicians are inflicting massive harm and disruption with little evidence to support their draconian edicts. Every local government is in a mimetic race to one-up each other in authoritarian city ordinance to show us who has, quote, abundance of caution. Politicians are competing, not on more evidence or more COVID-19 cures, but more caution. As unemployment rises and families feel unbearably burdened already, they feel pressure to, quote, fix the situation they created with even more radical and creative policy solution. This only creates more problems and an even larger snowball effect. The first place to start is to stop killing the patient and focus on what works. Start with basic hygiene. The most effective means to reduce spread is basic hygiene. Most Americans don't wash their hands enough and aren't aware of how to actually wash your hands. Masks aren't particularly effective if you touch your eyes with infected hands. More data. The best examples of defeating COVID-19 requires lots of data. We are very behind in measuring our population and the impact of the virus, but this has turned a corner in the last few days. The swift change in direction should be applauded. Private companies are quickly developing and deploying tests much faster than the CDC could ever imagine. The inclusion of private businesses in developing solutions is creative and admirable. Data will calm nerves and allow us to utilize more evidence in our strategy. Once we have proper measurement implemented, the ability to test hundreds every day in a given metro, Let's add even more data into that funnel and reopen public life. Open schools. Closing schools is counterproductive. The economic cost for closing schools in the United States for 4 weeks could cost between $10 to $47 billion and lead to a reduction of 6 to 19% in key healthcare personnel. Based on transmission evidence, children are more likely to catch COVID-19 in the home than at school. As well, they are more likely to expose older, vulnerable adults, as multi-generational homes are more common. As well, the school provides a single point of testing a large population for a possible infection in the home to prevent community spread. Open up public space. With such little evidence of prolific community spread and our guiding healthcare institutions reporting the same results, shuttering the local economy is a distraction and arbitrary with limited accretive gain outside of greatly annoying millions and bankrupting hundreds of businesses. The data is overwhelming at this point that community-based spread and airborne transmission is not a threat. We don't have significant examples of spreading through restaurants or gyms. When you consider the environment COVID-19 prefers, isolating every family in their home is a perfect situation for infection and transmission among other family members. Evidence from South Korea and Singapore show that it is completely possible and preferred to continue on with life while making accommodations that are data-driven, such as social distancing and regular temperature checks. Support business and productivity. The data shows that the overwhelming majority of the working population will not be personally impacted, both individually or their children. This is an unnecessary burden that is distracting resource and energy away from those who need it the most by preventing Americans from being productive and specializing at what they do best, their vocation. We are pulling resource towards unproductive tasks and damaging the economy. We will need the money for this fight. At this rate, we will spend more money on, quote, shelter in place than if we completely rebuilt our acute care and emergency capacity. Americans won't have the freedom to go help those who get sick, volunteer their time in a hospital, or give generously to charity. Instead, big government came barreling in like a bull in a china shop, claiming they could solve COVID-19. The same government that continued to not test incoming passengers from Europe who couldn't manufacture enough test kits with 2 months' notice. Let Americans be free to be part of the solution, calling us to a higher civic duty to help those most in need and protect the vulnerable, not sitting in isolation. There's another article titled Coronavirus Vaccines and the Gates Foundation, which complements this other article I went through. It's by F. William Engdahl, E-N-G-D-A-H-L. It's on the globalresearch.ca in Canada. We must admit that at the very least, Bill Gates is prophetic. He has claimed for years that a global killer pandemic will come and that we're not prepared for it. On March 18, 2015, Gates gave a TED Talk on epidemics in Vancouver. That day, he wrote on his blog, quote, I just gave a brief talk on a subject that I've been learning a lot about lately, epidemics. The Ebola outbreak in West Africa is a tragedy. As I write this, more than 10,000 people have died. Gates then added, quote, as awful as this epidemic has been, the next one could be much worse. The world is simply not prepared to deal with the disease, an especially virulent flu, for example, that infects large numbers of people very quickly. Of all things that could kill 10 million people or more, by far the most likely is an epidemic. That same year, 2015, Bill Gates wrote an article for the New England Journal of Medicine titled, The Next Epidemic, Lessons from Ebola. There he spoke of a special class of drugs that involves giving patients a set of particular RNA-based constructs that enables them to produce specific proteins, including antibodies. Although this is a very new area, it is promising because it is possible that a safe therapy could be designed and put into large-scale manufacture fairly rapidly. More basic research, as well as the progress of companies like Moderna and CureVac, could eventually make this approach a key tool for stopping epidemics. Moderna and CureVac both today receive funds from the Gates Foundation and are leading the development of an approved COVID-19 vaccine based on mRNA, or messenger RNA. A global flu-like pandemic, in fact, is something that Gates and his well-endowed foundation have spent years preparing for. In 2017, during the Davos World Economic Forum, Gates initiated something called CEPI, the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations. Together with the governments of Norway, India, Japan, and Germany, along with the Wellcome Trust of the UK, its stated purpose is to, quote, accelerate the development of vaccines will need to contain outbreaks of future epidemics. He noted at the time that, quote, one promising area of vaccine development research is using advances in genomics to map the DNA and RNA of pathogens and make vaccines. By 2019, Bill Gates and the foundation were going full tilt with their pandemic scenario. He made a Netflix video which made an eerie imaginary scenario. The video, part of the Explained series, imagined a wet market in China where live and dead animals are stacked and a highly deadly virus erupts and spreads around the world. Gates appears as an expert in the video to warn, quote, if you think of anything that could come along that would kill millions of people, a pandemic is our greatest risk. He said if nothing was done to better prepare for pandemics, the time would come when the world would look back and wish it had invested more into potential vaccines. Well, that was weeks before the world heard about the bats and a live wet market in Wuhan, China. In October 2019, the Gates Foundation teamed up with the World Economic Forum and the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security to enact what they called a fictional scenario simulation involving some of the world's leading figures in public health. It was titled Event 201. You gotta love these simulations going on near or at the same time of catastrophic events. As their website describes it, Event 201 simulated an outbreak of a novel zoonotic coronavirus transmitted from bats to pigs to people that eventually becomes efficiently transmissible person to person, leading to a severe pandemic. The pathogen and the disease it causes are modeled largely on SARS, but it is more transmissible in the community setting by people with mild symptoms. And this article continues. It really gets into the players of the Event 201. Among the selected players, as they were called, was George Fu Gao, notably a professor and director of the Chinese Center for Disease Control and Prevention since 2017. He specialized in interspecies transmission of the flu virus, and he was also interested in virus ecology, especially the relationship between the flu and migratory birds, live poultry markets, and the bat-derived virus ecology and molecular biology. Also involved was the former deputy director of the CIA during the Obama term, Avril Haines. She also served as Obama's assistant to the president and principal deputy national security advisor. All of this shows Bill Gates has a remarkable preoccupation with the possibility of a worldwide pandemic outbreak he said could be even larger than the alleged deaths from the mysterious 1918 Spanish flu. And he's been warning everyone about this for the last 5 years. What the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation also has been involved in is funding development of new vaccines using cutting-edge CRISPR gene editing and other technologies. The Gates Foundation money is backing vaccine development on every front. Inovio Pharmaceuticals of Pennsylvania received $9 million from the Gates-backed Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations. And so they're using the radical new vaccine method known as messenger RNA. And the head of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, Dr. Anthony Fauci, the person at the center of the Trump administration virus emergency response, is connected with this Bill Gates Moderna company coronavirus vaccine called mRNA-1273. It's going to be rolled out in a matter of weeks, not years. On February 24th, it went directly to Dr. Fauci's NIH for tests on humans and not on mice. It's very interesting to examine Bill Gates' involvement here. The article concludes, add to this the fact that the Gates Foundation and related entities such as CEPI constitute the largest funders of the public-private entity known as the WHO, the World Health Organization, and that its current director, Tedros Adhanom, the first WHO director in history who is not a medical doctor, worked for years on HIV with the Gates Foundation when Tedros was a government minister in Ethiopia. And we see that there is practically no area of the current coronavirus pandemic where the footprints of the omnipresent Gates are not to be found. Well, I wanted to go over some of this information. I hope it was useful for listeners. That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.